the word soul itself. When you use the word soul, what exactly do we normally mean? Soul really means the stuff of which a thing is made. When we say this is the soul of an institution, the soul of the home, the soul of life, what we mean is that it is that without which the thing concerned could not have been made. It is the real stuff of which the thing is made. So when we say that we want to concern ourselves with the soul, what we are meaning is that that which is the real stuff, without which we cannot be what we are. Now this word soul is used loosely by many people in many circumstances, many contexts. And that is why there is a great deal of confusion on this subject. So apart from this definition that I have given you, we shall deal with some of these confusions which are in this world about this subject. The word soul is sometimes used for anything that is abstract, something that is ethereal, something that is intangible, something that is not capable of being seized upon, something that escapes us, something that seems to be lying above us. Now, these words also are not entirely inapplicable to the real soul, but they do not indicate exactly what the soul is. First of all, the soul is not really intangible as many people believe it to be. Soul is not abstract. Soul is not something that cannot be seized, that cannot be grasped. To talk in positive terms, soul is concrete. In fact, in our experience, when soul is experienced, you feel that even the solidity of this substance is not so solid as that one. When you really experience a soul, its concreteness is so great. Therefore, the ordinary idea that the soul is abstract is fundamentally not correct. It is abstract only in the sense that in our ordinary life, we take only material substance to be solid and everything else to be abstract. But actually speaking, this matter is less concrete than the soul itself. When you really experience it, you feel solidity and the stuff of it to be so powerful that it will be even much more solid than a heavy pillar of steel. That much is the solidity of the soul. It is true that it is above all that we know at present. But it is also in everything that we know. It is above, but it is also in everything that we know. It is as if like milk which is mixed with water. So that milk is present in everything that is there, even in water that is there, milk is present. So the soul is present in everything, in the body, in our movements, in our thoughts, in our feelings, emotions, impulses, predilections, preferences, attractions. In everything it is present. Because actually it is the stuff of which all this is made. So it is bound to be present everywhere. Now there is another idea of the soul which is conceived in the terms of a ghost. Very often people speak of soul as spirit, and people say that when man dies, then a spirit goes on moving about in the house, in the surroundings, and sometimes can be seen also by some people, and they call it a ghost. In fact, there is a great play of Shakespeare called Hamlet, perhaps you might have seen. And the very first scene of Hamlet starts with the ghost. The story was that Hamlet was studying in a big university. He was a very bright and brilliant student. And suddenly he's called back home because his father is dead. And everything is gloomy when he returns to Denmark. He's the prince of Denmark. And the entire play begins with the castle in the night, where Hamlet is waiting for his friend's arrival. And there is hush. And the first one to arrive is Horatio, his friend. And when he enters the castle, he asks, "Is there anything?" He said, "Not even a rat." Just to indicate that everything is so quiet, so much in hush. And then they discuss what Hamlet claims to have seen previously, namely the ghost of his father. And then they dispute the existence of the ghost. And while the disputation goes on, suddenly the ghost appears before Hamlet. And Hamlet says, "Look, look, he beckons me. Nobody else can see, only he sees." And Horatio is horrified. But Hamlet moves behind the ghost because the ghost is beckoning him. And then he disappears from the scene and then meets the ghost alone. "Good morning, Matthew. Very fine." So he talks to the ghost, and the ghost tells him that he was murdered, and murdered by his uncle, in which his own mother conspired. This is a horrible story that he hears from the ghost. A murder of the father in which the uncle himself was the murderer, and in which his own mother, that is the wife of the king, had conspired. And he is unable to believe it. But the father says, "Don't you see that your mother immediately married your uncle after my death?" And gives a proof, as it were, of something that had happened. Now, Hamlet's entire tragedy hangs upon this story of the ghost. Ghost revealing to Hamlet a story which he cannot bear. He had such a great regard for his mother. He himself was a man of great morality and moral standards, in which loyalty, faithfulness, sincerity played the highest role in his life. He could never believe that his own mother could conspire to kill her own husband, who was such a great man. And this man, his uncle, was not even 1/100th of what his father was. So how could his mother put so low? It was impossible for him to believe it. At the same time, the ghost was telling him a story, and then the ghost tells him, "Take revenge." This is the special kind of mission that is given by ghost to Hamlet. The question before Hamlet was whether to believe in the ghost or not. Who knows what is the truth of the story? So Shakespeare has given a very vivid description of the interplay between man living man and the dead man, and how the dead man, through his ghostly appearance, influences the life of the whole of Denmark. In fact, ultimately, the entire play shows how the doubt in the mind of Hamlet plays havoc with himself, plays havoc with his own beloved Ophelia. Ophelia was the one in whom he had complete confidence, and they were to be married. They were madly in love with each other. Unfortunately, the father of Ophelia, Polonius, was the chief advisor of the king, and he was a worldly wise man. And the constant advice that he was giving to his daughter was, look, he is the prince and you are only a courtier's daughter. There is no comparison. Princes use you for fun and frolic, and you will go nowhere in life if you remain in this affair. So withdraw from it. And she is motherless, so she has nobody to turn to for advice. Now, when Hamlet is shattered by the doubt in his mind because of the ghost revelation, he begins to wonder, what is woman? Can woman be like this? And begins to doubt even Ophelia, that if his mother can be like this, can Ophelia be faithful? And this is his basic question in his life. Unfortunately, exactly at this time, the father advises Ophelia not to respond to Hamlet. So although she wanted to respond to him with all her heart, whenever Hamlet appears before her, she tries to withdraw. And that shatters him further. Ultimately, he has a chance once to speak to his own mother and ask her this question. So mother, of course, does not reply and asks her son to be absolutely quiet and calm and all that. But he says, I cannot be. At the same time, he does not believe in ghosts because he's a great philosopher himself, man of great thought. So to believe or not to believe, that was the question. As a result of which, his famous soliloquy, to be or not to be, that is the question. That was his basic thing. That if this is all that life presents to us, why should we exist in this world? So he wants to commit suicide himself. And the only one thought which prevents him was that who knows after death what happens to man? Maybe that I make an exit from this life and this trouble. But perchance a dream, but the dream may be terrible after this death. So the only thing that prevents him from committing suicide was this. See, ultimately he does not commit suicide. The ghost appears again before him and says, remember, remember, remember. So again he stirred up. And he wonders what is to be done. In a fit of anger one day, he kills Ophelia's father. Simply because he finds that this is the man, a crooked man, who constantly prevents Ophelia from coming to him. And also maybe that he's a crooked man also partner in the plot. Who knows? So in a fit of anger, he kills him. That affects both Ophelia and her brother, Laertes. And Laertes comes down from outside because of the death of his father and now regards Hamlet to be his enemy number one because he's the murderer of his father. So the situation becomes more complicated. Then, in the state of doubt, since he cannot remain any longer, he feels that he must do something to find out the truth. So what does he do? He pretends that he has become mad and speaks words which mean nothing outwardly and yet mean quite a lot. For example, once he meets his uncle and he smiles. The uncle smiles. And he says that one smiles and smiles and yet you never lick it. So these are his famous words in fact. And the king is shaken by these pronouncements. Because although he speaks like a madman, the message goes home. And he wonders what has happened to Hamlet. He can't banish him because he was the prince actually. And his mother really loved him even then, because although mother had betrayed her husband, she was very much attached to her own son. So he could not banish Hamlet from the kingdom. So he had to suffer him. But because of the conflict in his mind, ultimately he invites a friend of his who is the leader of a troupe of drama and says, I'll tell you one story. You state the story, invite the king and queen to attend, and then let us see the reaction of the king and the queen to the story. And the story was a repetition of the plot in which the elderly king is conspired against by his younger brother and his own wife, and they put poison into the ears when the king is asleep, then through the ears the poison is administered. And when this is done, both the queen and king are affected adversely. It is at that time that Hamlet becomes sure that the story of the ghost is not untrue. And then of course he kills the king, his uncle. The mother faints and dies. And then Ophelia's brother, Laertes, at that time comes on the scene because he's the enemy of it. He kills him and Hamlet kills Laertes. Ophelia dies because she becomes mad because she doesn't get any support from anyone. So she drowns herself. So it's an overall tragedy entirely. The whole story is told by Shakespeare to point out that in human life, the role that can be played by doubt is horrible. And one can lead to overall tragedy unless one becomes very clear, particularly about the inner realities of life. Men live basically on the outer surface, but there are many inner realities like the ghost, for example. Now, whether to believe in ghost or not, ultimately he came to realize that the ghost was telling him the truth. In any case, the important message of this whole drama was that there are invisible realities which do play a role in life. But very often these ghosts are regarded to be the soul of man who comes out of the body and wanders about. But there is, truly speaking, a great distinction between the ghost of this kind and the pure soul. So this is the knowledge which India possesses, so that we do not confuse the two things. Ghost certainly exists, but ghost is not the soul. There is a vast difference between the ghost and the soul. And one has to know quite well, otherwise one can be misled into this kind of a mischief of the whole chain. What exactly is the ghost? And how is it different from the soul? The ghost is the stuff of the vital desires, which are very strong and persistent. And when the human body dies, then these desires still remain alive. And these desires have a kind of subsistence and even a form which is very similar to the form of the living man of which these desires were a part. So in certain conditions, It can be even seen physically. We might say an invisible visibility. And there are so many facts of this kind that there is no reason to doubt the existence of this. But they basically are a kind of a conglomeration of the desires of the dead man. And they are so strong that they persist for their satisfaction. There are human beings who are very attached to their wealth. And they know where the wealth has been stored. And after the death, the individual remains around the wealth and protects and can even harm the person who takes some kind of courage to steal away the money or to possess that money and so on. But it is not the soul. It is only a conglomeration of a few desires which have been left unsatisfied. And they are so powerful that they want to persist in the same old atmosphere. Now, over and above the vital desires, there are also mental thoughts. So a great distinction is made between desires on one part and mental thoughts on the other. Now, this entire science is very briefly given in one Upanishad, which is called Taittiriya Upanishad, T-A-I, double T-I-R-I-Y-A, Taittiriya Upanishad. You know, there are 12 main Upanishads. There are actually 108, but 12 Upanishads are very important Upanishads, like Isha Upanishad, Katha Upanishad, Keno Upanishad, Chandogya Upanishad, Vyadharanika Upanishad, Mundaka Upanishad, Mandukya Upanishad. Taittiriya Upanishad is also one of these 12 Upanishads. They are extremely important because they give in brief what is given at length in the Vedas. Vedas are a very vast literature. Thousands of mantras are there in the Vedas. Four big books. And even in one lifetime, you can't read them, actually. They are so huge. And they are all in Sanskrit. And in a language which you can't understand. So, but Upanishads are more intelligible. Not entirely intelligible, but more intelligible. That is why many people turn to Upanishads to understand what is written in the Vedas. They are very brief. For example, Isha Upanishad has only 18 verses. But in 18 verses, the whole philosophy of Veda is contained. Some other Upanishads are smaller or bigger. Taittiriya is quite a long one. But it is a very important Upanishad, which says that a human being is basically composed of three parts. And say there is Annamaya, Pranamaya, Manomaya. Annamaya is the physical. Anna means food. And food is a word which is used in Sanskrit also for physical. Because food is always physical. Therefore, the word Anna is used also for that purpose. So it says that every human being has got a physical form, which is visible to all of us. But there is also Pranamaya. There is a vital self. This vital being consists of desires. Now the word desire is only a kind of a small abbreviation of many things. There is first of all instinct at the base of the desire. And there is a distinction between instinct and desire. Instinct is even unconscious. The desire is always conscious. When you say, I desire something, you are conscious about it. But instinct, even though there is impulsion, you may be unconscious about it. When you say, instinctively I got up, you may not have even intended, but instinctively you get up. So, an instinct is an urge to do something. without any voluntary decision or even any conscious decision. You may also become conscious of it, but for doing that, you may not need to take a conscious decision. I become angry, it's an instinct. Anger is instinct. Curiosity is instinct. You hear some sound, immediately I want to know what is it. I enter into some house, immediately I begin to look around. There's curiosity, simply. There may be no purpose in looking around, but there is a real curiosity to find out what it's all about. Sexual desire is also instinct. There are some attractions which are instinctive. There are some repulsions which are instinctive. Like, for example, the Mongols has an instinctive dislike and enmity against the snake, and vice versa. Instinctive. Similarly, among human beings also, there are instinctive attractions, instinctive repulsions. They are involuntary. But all of them imply some kind of action. All instincts are, as it were, drives of action. They result always in action. There is also an emotional feeling, and there is also a drive towards action. Now, this is the lowest part of our desire. At a little higher level, instinct begins to manifest as a desire, in which you consciously begin to have an intention, motive, and impulsion to do something to satisfy the intention and motive. There is also a distinction between motive and intention. Usually we use the word two words similar, as if interchangeably. But there is a distinction between motive and intention. My motive to go to the library, maybe to get the knowledge so that I can pass the examination. That is overall object is called the motive. But when I go to the library, I intend to take a book. So intention is a kind of a purpose which I want to fulfill in order to realize a higher object. The higher object is motive, and any other intentions which I have to fulfill that higher objective is called intention. In a desire, there is an emotion involved. The base of it may be instinct. But base of it may not be your instinct. You may have gone over the instinct. So although in the beginning it may have begun with an instinct, afterwards you begin to have a conscious desire for an object in which there is emotion involved in it. Then there is a purpose involved in it, which is translated as motive. And then there may be intention of doing something. And usually, the desire has a kind of an urge to fulfill itself. At a still higher level, there may be pure emotions. Not desires, but emotions, which are states of feelings. When you go to a beautiful forest full of flowers, you feel very happy. Now there is no desire to clutch at anything or to obtain something, but you feel happy. That state of happiness is an emotion. I am sitting with you and I feel very happy. There is a joy. There is no desire in it, but it's a state of happiness. Similarly, there may be an emotion of sorrow. There is no desire for sorrow, but yet there is an emotion for sorrow. So there are a number of emotions involved. One can have a long list of various kinds of emotions. The different strengths of emotions are called feelings. While I am talking to you, there is a real joy, but special movements of it may be feelings of joy. The basic state or status will be that of joy, and yet there may be so many small movements which are all feelings. I may talk to you, there may be fun, there may be wit, and it produces a feeling of greater happiness. Apart from a general state of happiness, it's a greater happiness. It's a feeling. So various branches of emotions are all feelings. Now this entire field, instinct, desire, emotions and feelings, this whole thing is called pranamaya. It is only one word because it is, prana means breath. It is all dependent upon breathing basically. According to Indian science, if breathing stops, all these things will disappear. It all depends upon breathing, because breathing is the real cause of what we call nervous reactions. If you examine our physiology, you will find that all emotions, feelings, desires, they are nothing but reactions of the nerves. If nerves stop, then feelings stop. Like in paralysis, for example, if something is paralyzed, the nerves are affected. They become numb, they do not function. Therefore, even if you touch, there is no feeling. And this paralysis happens because the breath has stopped in that part of body. The movement of breath has stopped. So prana is very important for the entire field of the instincts, desires, emotions and feelings. There is one more element in the field of vital or pranamaya, and that is will. There is a difference between desire and will. I may desire a cup of wine, glass of wine, but I may not will it. I may have a desire for it, but I know it is injurious to health. I know that it upsets my mind. I come out of my own self, as it were. I lose control over myself. Knowing all these consequences, even though I may desire it, I may not will it. For a desire to become a will, you must weigh the consequences of desire and then make a choice to put the desire into action. And when you do that, then that takes the form of will. Now, normally human beings are ruled by instincts. Normally, most of the human beings are only instinctive, like animals. Animals are instinctive only. They have very little of thought or any kind of memory or any imagination. But human beings also very largely are instinctive. We are packets of instincts, basically, you might say. But then these instincts are developed into desires. And some of the desires become very powerful in some human beings. Like desire turning into ambition. A kind of a longing. Desire becomes not only a desire for immediate satisfaction, but something like a longing, which can last for 25 years, 30 years, 50 years. People have ambition sometimes. Somebody says, I want to be prime minister of the country. It may take 50 years to realize that ambition. And one can sustain that kind of desire for a long time if there is a great longing for it. There are certain kinds of love where, for example, even if you are separated, husband and wife may be separate for many years. But if it's a true love, there's a longing to meet. And even if there are hurdles and hurdles in meeting, you overcome them, even if it takes years and years, So certain desires become longings, attractions, long-standing attractions. Now similarly, certain repulsions also become long-standing. That is how some people want to take revenge. It can be long-standing. May remain for 30, 40 years. There are many people we have seen, over 30 years the revenge is fulfilled, and then they feel satisfied in their life. So, there can be long-standing ambitions, long-standing attractions, long-standing repulsions. There can be also short-living desires. So, most of the human beings are instinctive, but when they become more conscious, they are ruled by desires. Out of desires, they begin to have many emotions, and some of which human beings begin to value more. When you say, in the company of yours, I feel happy. So, there are many things that I experience. Out of them, I select that I will like to be with so and so for such and such time, whenever I get time. Whenever Arvind is present, I feel very comfortable. So, I always go to him whenever I feel time. So, emotions which are more stable, they arise out of experiences of desires. And then comes the question of will, as I told you. When you have experienced the consequences of desire, and then you consider pros and cons, and decide whether you want the satisfaction of desire, or you can control the desire, you want to master it, you want to eliminate it, all this is the operation of will. It is therefore said that a human being, as long as his only instinctive is purely animal, when he begins to have some desires, he starts becoming human. But it's only when he begins to develop will that his manhood really comes into picture. A man who has no will or not developed willpower has not yet entered into manhood. He is carried away by desires, instincts, impulses, passions. He is not in his self-possession. That is why it is said that the most important thing in education is to develop the willpower of the child. Because child is normally instinctive, and gradually he has to grow into manhood, and therefore the insistence upon development of willpower. Now this is true of all human beings, because we are also children actually, all of us. And we also need to develop quite a lot. So for human beings, the most important thing is to develop willpower. All this is the subject matter of Pranamaya. So there is a huge complexity in every human being. And if you really open it, you will find so many kinds of things. It is like a drawer which is full of computing. Papers and pencils, various colors, and certain torn pages, and certain pages that are crumpled. Similarly, our whole vital life, if you open the drawer of our vital being, Pranamaya, you find all kinds of things littered, almost in a chaotic manner. This is what we are normally. But the willpower develops basically when the third element develops, that is Manomaya, the mental. Now let us think a little bit of what is mind actually. Just as the vital is a field of feelings, emotions, desires, similarly mind is a field of conception. There is a distinction between feeling and conception. Now, what is conception? A conception is a form in which the object, which is physical or any other object, is represented. A representative form of an object is called conception. And normally this conception is expressed in the form of words. all our capacity of using the words is because of the power of conception. I see a table. Now, next time if I want to tell you about the table, I have two ways of expressing it. One is to take you to the table and say, look, this is what I mean, in which conception is not necessary. I bring to you to the table and show you, this is what I mean. This is the table of which I want to speak to you. Or else, if I know the trick of conception and the use of the words, then without the need of bringing you to the table, I can simply say, I want to speak to you about the table. I use the word table, and immediately what happens to your mind is that the image, representation of the table comes to your mind. Now, this representation of the table is the conception. Now, this is a great capacity of man, that it is, he is capable of these representations. You might say it's a gift, you might say. All human beings have this gift, that they have the possibility of representations of various things, and therefore within a small compass, you can contain so many objects because of representations. Now, because of the brevity, all representations are brief as compared to the objects. The word table or the concept table is smaller than this table itself. So because of the brevity, the capacity of connecting objects becomes quicker. Therefore, the advantage of the mind is that by the use of mind, you can quickly connect many objects and understand their interrelationship. Now, here again, there is the word interrelationship is very important. Just as mind is fundamentally a capacity of conception, mind is also a capacity of understanding. We usually say that when you entertain your mind or train your mind, you begin to understand things better. So we consider mind as an instrument of understanding. And if you ask the question, what is the meaning of understanding? When do I say I understood? When do I say I don't understand? Both ways we can try to understand the thing. When I don't understand, when I understand. You understand a thing first when you can touch it. That is one way of understanding. A thing is understood when you touch it, when you grasp it in your hand. But even that is not sufficient. We may say that even if you touch an object, you may not really understand it. Take, for example, the story of Othello, Shakespeare's story again. That is a story in which the major part is played by the handkerchief. Othello and Desdemona love each other tremendously. Because of the love affair, they marry each other and they escape from where they were and go elsewhere. And they lead a very happy life until one man goes on telling Othello that Desdemona is unfaithful to him. That man is Iago. He goes on, he's a poisonous man, and he cannot bear the happiness of Othello and Desdemona. He simply wants to disrupt this happiness. So goes on telling him that Desdemona is unfaithful and gives a kind of a story that Othello's friend, who visits him quite often, is specially entertained by her. false story he makes up. She is so attentive to him. Just see. You watch. And that spoils the whole mentality of Othello. But he is so sure of his wife that even though temporarily these doubts come in his mind, he just throws them out. And Iago finds that Othello is invulnerable and the deception that he wanted is not possible. Then he devises a kind of a plot. He bribes or persuades a maidservant of Desdemona to steal the handkerchief which was presented by Othello to her as a special gift, which was prized above everything. And that handkerchief is given by the maidservant to Iago. Having come into possession of that handkerchief, he tells Othello that I have now approved of the unfaithfulness of Desdemona.
What is the proof?
Says, you prize above all the handkerchief that you have presented to Desdemona. You know where is it lying now? It's not with her. She has presented to your friend. He doesn't believe it at all. It's true. But he comes home and asks for the handkerchief. And she's quite sure the handkerchief is there. But unfortunately it is not there. And she comes back empty-handed. And this infuriates Othello tremendously. It is for him the last straw on the camel's back. After so many accusations which he had heard over months, this becomes a clinching proof that now Desdemona is really unfaithful. And he becomes so angry, that he murders. And soon after the murder, that maidservant enters. And on seeing this, and asking as to what is the reason, handkerchief. And she says, but I gave it to Iago. And the whole thing becomes so terribly topsy-turvy in his mind that he accused her absolutely falsely. There was no ground at all, such a faithful, such a beautiful woman. And he had done such a great injustice to everybody in the world. And he cannot even look at himself. So he kills himself. It's a tragedy. Now the story basically rests upon a handkerchief. Now many people may see handkerchiefs, but the way in which Othello sees it makes him understand many things. The whole story becomes quite different on seeing one handkerchief. So mere seeing an object is not enough for understanding. The context in which an object is seen is very important for understanding. So all understanding basically is the grasp of an object in the context of everything else. When the context is seen, then you say, yes, now I understand. Mere object is not enough. The interrelationship of an object with all the rest is what is called understanding. Now the human mind is capable of conception, it is capable of understanding. And thirdly, it is capable of withdrawing from the rush
of all emotions. This is the third capacity of the mind. It is difficult very often, but it is capable. This is one of the special capacities of the mind. That it can gradually withdraw and become a witness. Pure witness. I can observe my own anger. Although very often when I am angry, I become anger myself. I even lose all control over myself when I don't even know that there is anger. I simply am a wave of anger myself. It's only explosion and nothing else. But when the mind has been trained to withdraw itself more and more, particularly when in the calmer moments, when we have trained our mind to become more and more a witness self, then even when the anger overpowers you, then this habit of witnessing comes to our help. And you can see yourself that yes, now anger is rising. I am being overtaken by anger. Explosion is taking place. And you can even intervene. Because of this witnessing consciousness, you can intervene and can stop anger. Or at least the manifestation of it. Even if anger remains, you can stop the manifestation of it. Now, this intervention of the mind is actually the action of will, of which is spoke earlier. So, without the mind, there is no action of will. Therefore, will is also usually called intelligent will. There is intelligence which works in order that will operates. And this will operates because of the capacity of the mind to withdraw from the rush of emotions, desires, instincts, impulses. And this is a great capacity of the mind. So when we speak of educating a child in mental development, three things which are necessary are the power of conceiving, the power of understanding, and the power to withdraw from the rush of emotions so that one can witness them. These three powers are extremely important in mental education. Now, every human being normally has got these three elements, the body, the vital, and the mental. But none of these is the soul. Although soul is present in all of them, because they are, soul is the stuff of everything, but soul is still different from all the three. Many people think that the mind is the soul. Just as many people think that the vital prana is a soul, which it is not. Similarly, many people think that the mind is a soul, because mind seems to be uplifted and high and can move about in imagination. It looks as if it is ethereal, something corresponding to our concept of something that is superior and high. Now, it is true that mind is certainly superior to many things in our consciousness. But there is still something deeper than mind. And that is the soul. In Sanskrit, it is called antaratman. Now, how to distinguish between mind and the soul? Just as we distinguish between vital and the mind, we say that vital is a field of feelings, instincts, and so on, whereas the mind is a field of conception. How do we distinguish between mind and the soul? Now, since the soul is the stuff of everything, it will naturally have qualities which are presented in the body, life, and yet it will have some qualities which are distinctive. The soul, for example, has the kind of substantiality which even matter has got. It has feelings just as the vital has got. It has the knowledge just as the mind has got. Now, these three things are present in the soul. and yet it is something else. What is that something else? First, a spontaneous sweetness in the consciousness. Spontaneous sweetness, not dependent upon objects. In your presence, I may feel very sweet because of your presence. I may say you are very sweet. So I understand what is sweetness of relationship. But when the same sweetness or even greater sweetness is experienced without dependence upon any object, that is a sign of the soul. You might say that soul, Kathopanishad, it is described as madhvadaha. Madhu means running. Adaha means eater. The soul is described as the eater of honey, the internal honey. It's like a sponge which constantly oozes out honey, as it were, spontaneously. Now, each one of us has got it. Just as mind, each one of us has got, only it needs to be trained and so on. Similarly, each one of us has got this basic stuff in us. It is full of sweetness, inherent sweetness. You don't have to manufacture it. You don't have to be in contact with some objects in the world to experience it. If you can really touch it, you will automatically find sweetness in it. And you will be filled with sweetness automatically. That is the first characteristic of the soul. Inherent sweetness of consciousness. Inherent. Not merely sweetness coming from outside, but which is inherent. It is inborn. Just as the capacity of thinking is inborn in the mind, similarly, the capacity of experiencing sweetness, independent of any object in the world, internally, is the speciality of the soul. The second characteristic of the soul is that it has an automatic knowledge of the truth. If it is alive, if it is brought into the real play, you put the soul in the presence of so many facts, so many people, it will automatically turn to the truthful man, truthful woman, truthful child, truthful, automatically. Just as the sunflower turns automatically to the sun, similarly, soul is like a kind of a needle which automatically turns to all that is truth. It has inherent capacity. In the mind, truth is to be sought for. In the mind, there is a mixture of error. We start with ignorance. We start with a doubt. And gradually eliminate errors and arrive at some kind of truths. It's a big labor. And that too we are not sure whether it is really true or not. We simply say, I think it may be true. Probably it is true. And to make it certain, you require so much of evidence. Then you can say, now I think it is really true. And even then a new evidence might break it. Who knows? Even if you have all the evidence and yet it may not be true. We see in the judgments of the courts how very often, with all the evidence which is brought, even clinching evidence, a wrong judgment is given. So mind is a seeker of truths. It may arrive at the truths, but it is never certain about. The soul, on the contrary, is automatically sure of what is. Therefore, if the soul consciousness is really discovered, and that is the problem which you shall come to, how to discover and all that. But if the soul consciousness is touched, it can automatically find out what is true and what is false. Therefore, he is compared with the swan. It is said that swan has a capacity of separating milk from the water. So that if milk and water are given to the swan, it will drink only the milk and leave out the water. It is so said, even legendarily. It may be true, may not be true, but it, as a comparison, it is a true comparison. That if you cook up something and give before the soul a cooked up story, the soul will automatically say, this much is true, this is false. It won't look for evidence. It has inherent capacity of distinguishing between truth and falsehood. Similarly, it has another capacity of distinguishing between good and evil. Not only what is truth and false, but even good and evil. Who is noble, who is not noble? Whether somebody is truly sacrificing or not, or only making a pretense of sacrifice, the soul can distinguish and can handle. Similarly, the soul has a real eyesight for beauty. Even in the ugly thing, it will find out what is the beauty. That is why when the mother has a real love for the child, the mother finds her child to be always beautiful because of this reason. That she finds out what is the beauty in the child. Because real motherhood is very near to the soul. All mothers in the world, in their real experience of motherhood, they are very near their soul. That is why motherhood is such an important thing in life, which fathers cannot explain, but mothers tell this very deeply. So sweetness is the first recognition of the soul, then the capacity of distinguishing truth from falsehood, capacity to distinguish good and evil, and the capacity to distinguish beauty and beautiful and ugly. Now there is a third element in the soul. It has an inherent knowledge of what is the purpose of the life in which it is involved now. What is the direction that this life must take? This is the question which everyone asks and for which you don't have ready answers. What is the purpose of my life? What am I here to do? I should be an engineer or a doctor or a lawyer or a coolie or a scribe or what? How do I know? What am I to do? If you give a chance to the soul, then soul has an answer. In fact, this is the one question which you can find in no book and which you can find only in the soul. What am I to do in life? There is no book in which an answer to this question can be heard. Because no book is written for you singly. Books can give you general guidance. But what is your specific work? That is to be found only in your soul and nowhere else. And that is why, if you really want to know what is my aim of life, it can be done only by going to the soul. So this is the fourth important element in the soul. The knowledge of the aim of life of this particular of this individual, of your own individuality. There is a further capacity of the soul. How to deal with the confusions, doubts and errors of the mind. How to deal with them. Secondly, how to control undesirable desires and wrong relationships which you build up in life. How to eliminate them. and how to overcome the obscurity of the physical, the resistance of the physical, illnesses of the physical. These three capacities the soul has got. How to deal with them. Not only it has knowledge of dealing with them, but it can deal with them. Not only has knowledge of dealing with them, but it has also the skill of dealing with them. You might say that soul is like both an architect and a mason. An architect is one who designs out of materials a beautiful structure. Similarly, soul has body, life and mind as materials. And soul knows how to design and harmonize body, life and mind in a beautiful manner. But like a mason, he also can ultimately construct that beautiful building. The soul has a further capacity. It can communicate deeply with the souls of others inward without even speaking, even without outer communication. It may use outer communication if necessary, but it's not necessary for this, not indispensable. It can communicate because it is a direct line, we might say. The telephonic lines of the soul with soul are very direct. And finally, the greatest capacity of the soul is that it is inherently aware of God. God is for most of the people an idea or a belief which is imposed from outside. And most of us doubt whether God really exists or not, particularly in modern times. But for the soul, God is a living reality. For the soul, the one object which is really real is God. It is in direct touch with God. And it can communicate with God. It has the sweetest relationship with God and can discover what is God's will and can manifest it. You know, in the Veda, of which I spoke earlier, the greatest discovery that our Vedic Rishis made was the discovery of the soul. They use the word for soul. The word they used for soul was Agni. And they said that his discovery of soul is so important that to explain to ordinary people, they said that you must light Agni every day in your house. This is a prescription made. And they made Agni the center of the entire Indian life. They said, for every turn of life you do havan, because you have to light the fire. This was to explain to the people who don't really understand the deeper language. But the deeper language was very also clear. It said that if you go inwardly, then you will discover the soul, which is like a flame, inner flame. If you experience the soul, you will experience it as a flame of aspiration. Flame which always moves upwards. Like fire, fire always moves upwards. It is always pure. In fact, impurities can be burned by fire, but fire is always pure. Whatever you may do, fire can never be impure. Similarly, soul is ever pure. Therefore, every human being is basically pure. And if you can really go to the soul of anybody, you can forget all the impurities of outer nature. All the things that we call this is ugly, this is wrong, this is bad. But when you come to the soul plane, every human being is pure in the soul. It doesn't mean that every human being in the outer being is pure. But if you really want to establish a true relationship with everybody, anybody, truly, you can find the soul of man a real purity in which everything can be burnt up. So if you really meet somebody and meet at the soul level, all past can be thrown out, wiped out. Everything can be forgotten, forgiven. It really vanishes. It's like a slate. And whatever you write, you can rub out of it. So soul is like that slate in which purity remains. Everything else can be wiped out. It's a special quality. Like the fire always remains pure. Whatever you throw into it is burnt away. All impurities are thrown out. Only the pure things remain. Such is the quality. That is why they discovered that soul should be compared with only one thing, and that is Agni. And that is why the Vedic Rishis made Agni the center of human life, of entire social life. And they said at every turn of life, you remind the human beings that they have to discover the Agni. The very first mantra of the Rig Veda gives the whole secret of the soul. It says, Agnim Kide. It says, how to approach Agni? You say, oh soul, I worship you. This is the secret mantra. If you want to find out your soul, you just say, oh soul, I worship you. If you constantly do it, the soul itself will come out in the flesh. And you'll begin to shine with the nature of the soul. Then it says, Agni Nire Purohitam. You are the leader. He's like an architect, as I said. He knows what is the design to be made and how to make it and so on. He's like a Purohit. Purohit does not mean priest, ordinary priest. Purohita means, Puroha means front, Hita means put forward. That which is put forward is called Purohita. So the soul is the Purohita, one who is always in the front. He is constantly guiding you, although you may not listen to his guidance. You may not be aware of it. He is always guiding you. It is Purohitam Yajyasya Devam Ritvijam. He is a Ritvija. Ritvija means he knows the cycles of development. Where you are now in the long cycle of development, you may have many passwords. It knows all the passwords. Where you are, it knows. In which direction you are going, it knows. What are the cycles by which you can move towards it, it knows. Such is the knowledge, so it is Ritvijam. Ritu means the season. The seasons of the soul's development are known to it. It is Hotaram. It is the one who can call all the powers from above. Because it is direct contact with God. So all the powers which are in God can be called by the soul. It is Ratnadhatam. It is there. Ratna means happiness, bliss, sweetness. It is the holder of all the bliss that is constituted and the highest bliss. So if a human life is to be a search for highest bliss, we can never get anything except through this. Only by going to the soul. So such is the importance of the soul in our search of life. If you are not tired, I'll continue. Yeah. Huh? You are tired now, Arjuna? Yeah. No? No? Sure? Yes. You tell me when you are tired, huh? So that we shall meet again sometime if you want to. Now the soul, which is called Antaratman, is a delicate of our real individual soul. The soul of which I spoke is only a delegate by itself. So there is still a deeper reality, which is called Jivatman. This is Antaratman, but there is also behind it, there is Jivatman. When people say the soul is Jiva, this is the word which is used very often in our Indian languages. Actually speaking, what they are referring to is this Jiva, which is even behind the Antaratman. Antaratman is that which is in our body, life and mind spread out, which is there within our heart, inside our heart. But Jivatman is still beyond it. It is the real individual center of God Himself. So now let us dwell upon this. It's a more difficult concept, but let us try to understand it. God Himself is universal. Therefore, He is called the cosmic self. He is spread out everywhere. And there are experiences in which you feel so wild and so intimate with everything in the world that all this seems to be one united thing. All diversity is as if there seems to be diversity of oneness. There are experiences of this kind. These are experiences of cosmic self. The Antaratman is mainly connected with the individual development. It can also open up with universality. But universality is not its constant experience. Whereas in the cosmic self, its very experience is cosmic all the time. And this cosmic self is an expansion which is never ending. It is therefore called expansion of the essence. Therefore, God is defined as essence, but is universal. This is the definition of God. God is essence, which is universal. Now, if you examine the idea of essence, you will find that essence is always something that is the same. However, maybe the manifestation of God, essence always remains the same. Then, for example, you may tell a story to indicate one basic truth. You may tell the story in 10 different ways, but the essence of the story remains the same. So the meaning of essence is that which is the same. And sameness means that whatever expression you may give, it remains unalterable. Now, expressions can be small, can be wide, can be widest. As wide as the whole of space, whole of time. So even if there is an expression of the essence as wide as the whole of time or whole of space, it still remains the same. And this can happen only if it is more than space and time. If it still remains the same, therefore it is called the God is spaceless and timeless, which is capable of infinite space and infinite time. So it is called Sat. Sat is the essence, that which is. It is also called transcendental, that which transcends all that we can conceive, all the expressions. Essence by nature is always transcendental, because it transcends all expression. So God is transcendental and capable of universality. It can expand and manifest itself. It is also capable of, it's a very special capacity of God, of containing himself fully in individual center. This is one of the surprising capacities of God, that it can concentrate the whole of it, all that is itself, in any small individual sensation. It is somewhat like a poet writing a poem of 7 lines or 14 lines, a sonnet, and says that all my message is contained in this 14 line. All that he has thought, all that he has lived, all that he has experienced is contained in this 14 line. A great poet is capable of it. Similarly, God can contain himself in a small centration of itself. And as you open up, it opens out itself to the whole cosmos and to the transcendental. So you might say that centration of God, which is capable of infinity, which is capable of universality, and which is capable of transcendence, and yet a centration, a finite, which is capable of containing infinity, this is Jivatma. Every one of us is basically that, of which the soul of which I spoke is a delegate. Centration of the transcendental and the universal, which is capable of universalization and transcendence. Because it is itself a centration of the universal and the transcendental. Therefore, from this side, it can also expand into infinity, into universality, into transcendence. Jivatman is God himself, but in a finite centration. It always remains united with God. If you really discover your Jivatman, you will find that he is all the time united with God. He is not to make an effort to unite with God. He is all the time united with God. That is why it is said that if you really want to see yourself, who you are, truly, the best perception of it is given in the Ras Lila of Shri Krishna. If you can see the Ras Lila, sometimes in rare moments you can have this vision in which Krishna is dancing with gopis. Each gopi is a Jivatman and you are one of them already. Whether you know it or not, each one of us is already engaged in the dance with Sri Krishna. All the time we are engaged. Basically our work is only that. We are constantly in play with Sri Krishna or with the Lord himself, with God himself. This is our basic status. So when you realize yourself truly, the self-knowledge when it arises, you find that you are constantly in play with the Lord already. There is no division of him from God. He is all-knowing. There is no knowledge which is denied to it. The delegate has knowledge, as I told you, but compared to that knowledge of Jivatman, which is omniscient, the true Jivatman
He has all the knowledge. And this Jivatman obeys God's decisions automatically. There is no disobedience automatically. Now, I'll tell you a story in a story form. A time came in the play of Shri Krishna or the Lord himself. Shri Krishna is a symbol of the Lord. When the Lord decided to have a certain kind of play, he is capable of many kinds of play because there is nothing that is impossible for God. So he is capable also of a specific play. He is capable of all kinds of play. He is also capable of one kind of specific kind of play. So all the souls agreed to that play. Said, all right, whatever play you want to play, we are with you. So he said that I would like you to forget yourselves. But how to forget? There is omniscience. In omniscience, you can't forget anything. All knowledge is present. So God gave a kind of a process by which these individuals can forget themselves. What is that process? It has to be a gradual process because it can't be abrupt. Because there is omniscience all around. If you are living in the sea of knowledge, how can you forget anything? Because forgetfulness means ignorance of some kind. So in the sea of knowledge, this forgetfulness cannot come about. So gradually, he said that in the first condition, you are omniscient, therefore you have got comprehensive knowledge. Now the faculty by which comprehensive knowledge can be obtained is what is called faculty of truth consciousness. This is the Vedic word, truth consciousness. It is called Rita Chit. Rita means truth, Chit means consciousness, Rita Chit. All that is truth is known simultaneously without any effort in that faculty. It's quite different from mind. Mind has all the labor and groping and all that. Whereas that faculty which Jivatman has automatically is the faculty of omniscience, in which everything that is true is known comprehensively. That Vritta Chit is also called the super mind because it's quite different from mind. Mind is a groping ignorance, whereas supermind is a faculty of knowledge, not of ignorance. Supermind has to grope for nothing. It knows automatically. Anything it wants to know automatically knows without any effort. So it is also called the supermind. So you might say that the basic faculty of the Jivatman is supermind. Now this supermind has three capacities. All comprehensive knowledge, apprehensive knowledge, and projecting knowledge. I'll explain all the three points. Comprehensive knowledge, apprehensive knowledge, and projecting knowledge. In comprehensive knowledge, everything is known as one, united. All the variations which are there in the unity are all seen as harmonies of oneness. You can imagine a kind of an orchestra which is being played by a big piano master. And a huge symphony is being played. And the piano master has a complete mastery of each and every movement, all united together in one grand symphony. Somewhat like this is the consciousness of the comprehensive jivatma. But while doing that, just as an orchestra master, also it can be aware, and at the right moment it can point out for the flute player, now it is your turn now to play flute. While he is aware of the totality, he can also pinpoint the flute player now. Or now he turns to the violin man and says, now you play this tune in the violin. Now this capacity of specifying particular movements is called apprehensive consciousness. Somewhat each one of us has got this consciousness also, even in our life. I may know the whole story before I start the story to my child. And yet, as I tell the story, I give emphasis on one point rather than another point. I unfold it gradually. Now, this is a capacity of apprehensive consciousness. It does not abrogate the totality that you have in your mind, but your capacity of relating it step by step. So, manifestation of the totality in a step-by-step movement is what is called apprehensive movement, as opposed to comprehensive movement. Now, in an apprehensive movement, a third movement becomes possible. I just now spoke of emphasis upon one point as against another point. Now, when we emphasize one thing, then others become subordinated. This is always the case. So, if you play with emphasis and multiple emphases, then what happens is that certain points become much more prominent, other points become subordinated. Now, all the three are present simultaneously in the jivatman. Comprehensive consciousness, apprehensive consciousness, projecting consciousness. Just as the storyteller, when he tells a story, he has all the three consciousnesses present. The child may not be aware of all the three simultaneously, but the storyteller has got all the three simultaneously. So God has got all the three simultaneously. Jivatman has got all the three simultaneously. But having reached the point of projecting, emphasizing one thing, now a new possibility arises, and that is of exclusive concentration. When I emphasize one thing, it is quite possible that I may remain for a long time stressing that point. During that point in time, all the rest remains ignored. And if I will, and that is important, if I will, then I may remain stuck to that concentration and keep that all other points ignored for a long time. Something like an actor. I may be playing a role of Rama in the drama. I know the whole drama very well myself. I know also that I am not Rama actually. I am somebody else. But while playing Rama, when Sita has gone, captured away by Ravana, and I weep, I forget that I am an actor. I forget that I am, even in the drama, I am a great king. So noble and so mighty, that weeping for me is something quite inconsistent. Yet I weep, and weep thoroughly, truly, with all my heart. And the greater the concentration on my weeping, and the greater the forgetfulness of everything else, greater is my acting. The more I forget that I am really acting, the better is your acting. Now, this is a special power of what is called exclusive concentration of consciousness.
is the power of consciousness. So if God says that you forget yourself, if this is the command that He wants to play a game, that you forget yourself, then how to arrive at it? So Jivatman had to, first of all, live in three states of consciousness, comprehensive, apprehensive, and projecting. At the point of projecting, it had to take one step further, by which it became concentrated only upon one important point, and all the rest it put backward, behind, ignored it. It forgot that it is the jiva having the capacity of all comprehensive consciousness, apprehensive consciousness, projecting consciousness. It forgot. It was not abolished. When the actor is acting as Rama, that he is not Rama is not abolished. He has got his own family, he will go back at home and he will meet his wife and children and so on. He is not abolished. His family is not abolished. But for this moment, family doesn't exist, he doesn't exist, the whole drama doesn't exist, only his weeping exists. It's a very special quality of consciousness which he exercises. You may not exercise it, you may are free not to exercise it. But if God has willed that He wants to play a game of this kind, then it is possible for Him to play this game. So at a given time, to follow God's game, it agreed to forget itself. Jivatman agreed to forget itself. This act is called the act of ignorance. Ignorance means ignoring. You ignore the whole of the rest, concentrate only on one point. It doesn't mean also that Jivatman is not enjoying the three states of consciousness at the same time. Only in that exclusive concentration of consciousness, it is not aware of it. But it is still aware of it there. There is a state of consciousness, even in the actor who is acting now as Rama. There is a state of consciousness where he can, his relationship with his wife is not abolished. It is there. Even that consciousness is present, but not present in the frontal consciousness. Now this word frontal is very important. All forgetfulness arises out of making a distinction between frontal consciousness and inner consciousness. In the inner consciousness, the jiva continues as before. His constant play with God continues. His lila is continuing. But in the frontal consciousness, it is left out. Now, all of us are in that condition of self-forgetfulness. We are all jivatmans. All our jivatmans are here. We are, you are jivatman, I am jivatman, she is jivatman. Each one of us agreed with God, made a contract with Him, and said, since we want to play a game, the purpose of it we do not know, but you know the purpose, but we are game, and we shall participate in your game. So we shall agree to play this role, and we put back our consciousness of you, our consciousness of ourselves in the center of God, our capacity of universalization, our capacity of comprehensive consciousness, apprehensive consciousness, projecting consciousness. Even when they are operative, we shall remain unconscious about it. But unconscious only in that point. You can always recover it if you want. You just go backward and you will recover it. And you will find that always you were in that consciousness. Now this is what has happened to all of us. Now after this, there is a further point. That each one of us actually knows why God has done this. Jivatman really knows why this kind of game has been selected. And the purpose of it was the following. This is the great secret of the universal minds. Why this self-forgetfulness? That it is only by self-forgetfulness that gradually this self-forgetfulness can be brought to such a point that it becomes completely unconscious. First of all, self-forgetfulness is partial. But gradually, you can reach a point where a stage is reached of complete unconsciousness. Now again take example of the actor of Rama. When he concentrates only on weeping, he becomes so much one with weeping that even further there is weeping. His concentration on weeping is so great that even forgets his weeping really. He is not even conscious of it. It is only an act of weeping. Then it becomes a real acting. So, arriving at complete unconsciousness was the first intention of God. A complete opposite of himself. God is full consciousness. But through the consent of the individuals, this possibility was created in which complete unconsciousness can be created. Now, if this unconsciousness can then be broken afterwards, then the delight which comes out of the breaking is so intense that such a delight is not available anywhere. Even in his highest consciousness, that kind of delight is not available, which can be available after breaking this unconsciousness. So to attain to that kind of experience of the highest kind of delight, it was necessary to forget, to arrive at unconsciousness, and then to gradually break it. And during the breaking, of course, lot of suffering is available, is produced during that period. But if you go on pressing forward, and when you really break this unconsciousness, even partial unconsciousness, then, and when you rise up again to that original thing, then something else would have been added to it, which was not available in the beginning. Intensest delight. A kind of perfection in the exact opposite conditions. It is, you might say, that if you really want to understand the value of water, unless you become very thirsty, you won't understand what it means to be quenched. The real value of water is realized not when water is available easily, but when it is, you are deprived of it, and when you are very thirsty, and then when you get the water, the delight of it is there. It is not available when you are getting water quite normally. Similarly, when you are deprived of it, deprived of the real consciousness, and then gradually when you rise into it, it's completely broken, and there's a rush of consciousness, and the delight that comes is tremendous delight. Now to gain this experience, this whole drama had to be played. So each one of us has agreed to this drama. It is now no more possible for you and for you and for her to say, I don't like this drama. We have already agreed to God that we have agreed that this drama should be played, and we should play, each one of us will play his own role. Now in this drama, each Jivatman is given a specific role. It is as if God is playing the big orchestra in which each one has a certain part to play. And we have agreed to play that part. So we are here now at a stage, not at the original stage where there is complete darkness, because that was long, long ago. Then came matter, then came life, then came mind in the evolutionary process. And now we are here with our ordinary consciousness of mind. We are slightly conscious, slightly unconscious, all kind of bundles we are. Now it is in this present state that we feel all kinds of dualities, contraries, happiness, misery, knowledge, ignorance, honor, dishonor, victory, defeat. All kinds of dualities we are experiencing. It's an important stage of development. And at every step of suffering is a reminder that you have to act ultimately to break the ignorance. Do not cry over the suffering which is there. It is inevitable because you are rising from unconsciousness towards consciousness, in which all kinds of experiences will be there of dualities. And if you feel uncomfortable, it is inevitable. In the ignorant consciousness, how can you expect a complete felicity? You can't. This is the normal state of our consciousness. At the moment you feel pain, you see that is God's message to you, that now the time has come for you to break this and to move forward. Now this knowledge has been given by the Jivatman to the psychic being as a delegate. Therefore psychic being has got the knowledge, automatic knowledge, of what has gone behind so many births, where you have reached now, and where you have to move forward. Therefore, at any given stage in life, wherever there is a problem, we should take the problem as an indicator of the need to break the limitation by going back to the soul. That's the most immediately available to us. In our present consciousness, Jivatman is more difficult because it is far off, as it were. But the nearest to our body, life and mind is this Antaratman, which is seated inwardly. Jivatman has sent this delegate into us so that we may get the guidance more easily. Therefore, the need for individuals to discover this soul as soon as possible, particularly when we are in a situation where we really feel some kind of suffering, some kind of a need to come out of it and to really enter into a new consciousness. This is the second part of my talk. One part remains. If you are tired, you shall take it up next time. Okay?